Hello, welcome to a podcast for the Lancet Child and Adolescent Health. I'm Gavin Cleaver. Now today I'm joined by Lorna Fern of UCL to discuss the Bright Light study, looking at the importance of early diagnosis in adolescent and young adult cancer in the UK. Lorna, welcome. Will you tell us a little bit about your background?
And welcome to you. So my name's Lorna Fern and I am the chair of the National Cancer Research Institute's Health Services Research Subgroup within the Teenage and Young Adult Clinical Studies Group. And I'm also the researcher for that group. And I've worked on the Bright Light study since its inception, actually, and also during the feasibility work back in 2008.
Well, we're very happy to have you with us today. So your study, it looked at diagnostic timeliness of adolescents and young adults with cancer. How are cancer and its diagnosis in this particular age group different from those in younger children and in adults as well?
Okay, so there are a number of reasons why cancer and its diagnosis is different for our adolescents and young adults compared to children and older adults. And I think, you know, to begin with, cancer in young people is much rarer. So within the United Kingdom, we would have around 2,000 new cases of cancer in young people aged 13 to 24 each year, which is actually less than 1% of the total incidence cases that we would see yearly for the UK. And in terms of cancer types, then young people present with a spectrum of malignant diseases, which is quite distinct to that we see in children and older adults. So, for example, around half of all new cancer diagnoses in older adults would be of the breast or the lung, the colon and the prostate. I mean, these cancers are typically quite rare in young people, where the most common cancer type they tend to present with is lymphoma, and that tends to be Hodgkin's lymphoma. And so we would typically consider Hodgkin's lymphoma, the bone and soft tissue sarcomas and germ cells to be what we call true adolescent cancers, in that their peak incidence is within that adolescent and young adult age group. And while we do see carcinomas in that age group, they tend to be fewer. And we do see some early onset breast and colorectal cancers. We rarely see a lung or a prostate cancer. And we tend to see more thyroid cancers, cervical cancers, and head and neck cancers. And as I mentioned earlier, those early onset breast and colorectal cancers can occur. I think we know a little bit about the diagnostic process of cancer in young people compared to older adults. And we know that from routine data sets that young people are most likely to visit their GP with cancer symptoms prior to referral. And we also know that young adults are less likely to be referred through the emergency two-week wait compared to older adults. Although in many situations, this may be reflecting appropriate alternative care pathways for this group. If we look at healthcare-seeking behaviour, and comparing with children, the most obvious difference would be that with children, they will have their parents with them advocating for them and navigating their way through what can often be a complex healthcare system, while for our adolescents and our young adults, it may be one of their first independent interactions with the healthcare system. And I think more generally, if we consider the structure of our health service and how it's mainly set up around children's services and adult services, then young people really are a distinct group, and neither children or adult services are completely equipped to deal with the complex psychosocial needs that go along with a cancer diagnosis in young people.
Yeah, those are some very interesting points about first-line care, actually. It's the kind of thing that seems obvious when you say it, but it's not necessarily something that would occur to you before independently. It's very interesting. So your study is part of the Bright Light programme of research, which evaluates specialist care for young people with cancer in England. Could you just briefly summarise for us what you did in this particular study?
This paper, looking at the diagnostic timeliness of young people, is part of a broader programme of research funded by the NIHR. So that's a programme grant. And Bright Light is the largest study of young people with cancer in the world. And its principal research question is to examine whether specialist cancer services for young people with cancer add value. And you can find out more information about that programme of research on our website, which is www.brightlightstudy.com. And within one of the work streams of Bright Light, there is a cohort of around 1,000 young people who are being followed longitudinally over 3 years. And the data we present here is part of wave one, of which there are 5 waves altogether. So wave one is a face-to-face interview which lasts around 40 minutes and asks young people questions about their experience of care, including their pre-diagnostic experiences. And this was identified as an important area during the Bright Light feasibility work, where we worked with young people in developing the instruments that we used during Bright Light. And so we've examined this data and then we've enriched it with information from the Population-Based Cancer Registry of Public Health England to look at the timeliness of diagnosis for young people within the Bright Light study.
And so what were your key findings in the study?
So first of all, we've established a baseline characterising how quickly adolescents and young adults with cancer are being diagnosed within the study, and this includes information on the proportion of them who seek help from their general practitioner as part of their diagnostic journey. We also looked at the time from symptom onset to seeking help, so we would typically call this the appraisal interval, and we've also looked at the time from symptom onset to diagnosis, which in our sample was around 60 days, so there was large variation between patient groups, as you might expect. And this evidence is important because it is for the first time that we've managed to look at this, and it's something that we've struggled with within the adolescent and young adult cancer communities, gathering sufficient amounts of evidence to look at whether early diagnosis is a problem or not in young people. And I think the baseline that we've gathered here could be used in the future to evaluate the effectiveness of future interventions. And we've identified patient groups which may be at particular risk of prolonged patient intervals, and I think that's helpful because that allows us to identify groups where more research is needed in order to find out how we can support both young people to appropriately seek help for symptoms and also how we can support healthcare professionals suspect potential cancer symptoms in this group, which is really difficult. So our sample has shown that young people with melanoma have the longest patient intervals, so not recognising that actually changes in that mole may be potentially cancerous. And those patients who say have a testicular lump, which is more recognisable as something which may be a bit more sinister, they tend to have the shortest appraisal interval, so they're noticing their lump and they're seeking a healthcare opinion more quickly than those young people with melanoma. And I think interestingly and perhaps surprisingly, what we've found is that females tend to have consulted their GP 3 times or more before referral compared to males, and that's something which we feel is more investigation to try and tease out what that might be. And we also noticed that in terms of cancer types, young people with lymphoma and bone cancer were more likely to attend their GP 3 or more times. And as I mentioned earlier, these are what we call true adolescent cancers, and so we think this may be because of the relatively non-specific symptom signature of these diseases, which means their symptoms can be initially attributed to other illnesses. But in reality, we don't actually know enough about the symptoms and symptom development in young people to make firm conclusions at this point, which is why more research is needed. And we also found that young people with germ cell tumours, so mainly testicular cancers in this cohort, were likely to be referred more quickly by their GP, reflecting perhaps more commonly identifiable potential cancer symptoms in young people.
Yeah, so these variations in the diagnostic journey by cancer site seem like a really important part of your study. So what are the implications for clinicians, for healthcare professionals?
So I think, one of the things that I think is important is that we tend to talk about adolescent and young adult cancers as a group. And actually what this study illustrates is there's a need for us to look at groups within that, and that there are certain subsets, for example, melanoma or bone cancers, that we need to pay more attention to and prioritising for early diagnosis initiatives. Having said that, we are far from developing an intervention around early diagnosis for young people, as we need to know more about how the symptoms develop, what is going on during that patient interval. We need to know more about the GP consultations and clinical decision makings during those consultations, because there might be absolutely absolutely correct that the young person has to go three or more times to get to that point where it's necessary to refer on. And that's the sort of information that we're lacking at the moment. And I think it's important to remember that identifying potential cancer symptoms in young people is particularly difficult. We're talking about rare cancers in a rare group. And there's also been some work done by Rachel Domit's group in Bristol, which has shown that the positive predictive value, so that is the number of young people with a potential cancer symptom who go on to be diagnosed with the cancer, is really low for this group. And as we state in the paper, the highest positive predictive value was for lymphoma and the symptom of a lump in the neck. And even with this symptom, for every 1,000 young people presenting, only 5 would go on to be diagnosed with lymphoma. And so these positive predictive values to date for young people have not been as useful as they have been for older patients, where they've been used to develop risk assessment tools to help healthcare professionals identify people at risk or more likely to go on to have a cancer diagnosis. And again, this is why we need to think about new research, perhaps looking at service delivery and care pathways for young people, and developing and evaluating new diagnostic technologies for this group.
Right, so would you say those are the logical next steps in improving the diagnostic experience of young people with cancer?
Yes, absolutely. I think I don't think we can go from this paper into developing interventions there's a lot of unanswered questions still, and the voice that's missing from a lot of the early diagnostic work within young people is the voice of the GP, and it's a really difficult thing to do to identify potential cancer symptoms in this group. So our next steps here within the Bright Light team is to study the symptom profile of this cohort. So we have symptom data on this group, and look at to see if there are particular symptoms or symptom combinations which are at risk of a prolonged cancer diagnosis. And this can help with education campaigns. Our recent James Lind Alliance research priority setting exercise for teenagers and young adults with cancer, which we concluded on Friday, highlighted early diagnosis as a research priority within the top 5, so number 4 out of 10. However, I think we still have some way to go in understanding potential cancer symptoms in young people, how they are appraised, their interaction with healthcare professionals, and I think most importantly, outcomes associated with times to diagnosis. Because although survival of many AYA cancers is high, we need some studies onto the impact of early or late diagnosis on disease and treatment burden, quality of life, engagement with healthcare services after treatment, all of which are really important in this age group given the length of time they will live and their potential societal and economic contribution.
Well, it's a fascinating and important paper, and you can read it online now at the Lancet Child and Adolescent Health. Lorna, thank you so much for your time today.
Okay, thank you.